was the Union of Soviet Social Republics. And they'd say, oh, but aren't you so glad that you're in America? I said, well, I know a lot of Russian filmmakers. They have a lot more freedom than I have. All they have to do is be careful about criticizing the government.
Welcome to Pop Life, a show where we take more fun dives into different aspects of pop culture, movies, and of course, something I spent a long time doing, music. Please don't forget, if you like what you're seeing, please hit that like button. Please hit subscribe and the notification bell so you know whenever we go live. I know sometimes you guys still forget. It's been like a year now we've been doing these Wednesday shows. Granted, not as consistent, but still, I've been trying to do a calendar each week so you guys can see what the week of shows looks like. I try to drop it on Monday. Keep an eye out for that. I will not be here tomorrow, but there will be some surprise hosts returning. I'm not saying who, but definitely some members of the TIR crew will be back to run the show. Also, since this show is about music, I wrote a thing that is now a mini book you can purchase wherever you're watching or listening to the show. There should be a link in the description to the book that's out right now, Everyday Analysis. There's a new second edition out because the first edition sold out. Called I Was a Teenage Anarchist. Of course, the title is Steve says inconsistent Negroes. A little bit. I'm excited today because this show is always going to be definitely a very large departure from what we do on the main show. And one of the things that I definitely love to talk about, probably more than anybody else on the show, is music. And when I got an email saying, hey, I wrote a book about David Lee Roth, I was like, I don't need to see anything more. You don't need to say anything more in the email. All you need to say was I wrote something about David Lee Roth. I'm like, we can talk Van Halen on the show. I can have an excuse to talk about one of those seminal rock bands in my life. As someone who kind of accidentally fell into the role of frontman for a punk, heavy metal, hardcore band, many wouldn't imagine Van Halen would be a band that I draw inspiration from. But they were sonically and stylistically ingrained into my DNA by MTV and the cinema of the 80s as the definition of badassery and cool. Who can forget? Everybody wants some dancing claymation burger scene in one of my favorite movies, Better Off Dead. Is that not the best just injection of a perfect hard rock song? I have one left of my two Bay Area Eddie Van Halen wannabe guitars that were found in a dumpster and brought back to life by Luthier of the Stars, Greg Day. I was originally going to bring it out. I was like, no. But he had found these guitars in the warehouse, and I asked Greg if he could fix them. He said, sure, bro, no problem. And I was like, I have one request. Can you do the tape job like Van Halen on this one? But instead of making it white and red, it has to be the Giants colors, orange and black. Then I had a Golden State Warriors one. It was blue and yellow. That one, sadly, got left in Indiana. Yeah. While I knew I was never going to be Eddie Van Halen, I can't say I copied his playing style as much as his overdriven tone. But when it comes to overdriven personality, the ultimate frontman entertainer might be the diamond one, David Lee Roth. Like many people my age in the music video era, it was Panama and Hot for Teacher that had me hooked. And I was mildly heartbroken when Dave left the band or was fired. We'll talk more about that during the show. But seemingly without missing a beat, the comical frontman was on MTV with his solo work. DLR never stopped making great music, but it wasn't Van Halen, but it was still cool. Eventually, Roth reunited with his original bandmates to continue to rock stadiums like they did 40 years prior. Tonight, we'll discuss the man that defined what a frontman looked, sounded, and acted like in the 80s, David Lee Roth. Our guest tonight, Darren Paltrowitz, has written a biography on David Lee Roth titled How David Lee Roth Changed the World, the DLR Book. Darren is also the host of the Paltrowcast with Darren Paltrowitz, which airs regularly on over 150 television stations and OTT carriers, in addition to key podcasts and digital outlets. Paltrowcast guests have included major film and television stars Michael Cera, Johnny Knoxville, Joel McHale, The Fraggles. Fraggles. Wherever you are watching or listening, there is a link in the description to the book. Please welcome Darren Paltrowitz.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason. Thank you for that wonderful, wonderful intro. And yes, the Fraggles were on the Paltrowcast.
Okay. I have so many questions, but no. We're going to stick to Van Halen here. Okay. And that should be extremely easy. And I just got a text message a little bit earlier from a friend of mine, friend of the show. Sometimes he's a co-host and I can't be here, Kenzo Shibata. And he's like, dude, I'm going to jump in the chat. So hopefully Kenzo's in the chat messing with you guys. I definitely hope in the chat I hear great Van Halen stories. I want to see debates about what era is better. I want to see that one a-hole say that the Gary Cherone album really was a good album. Come on. I need to see this type of scuttlebutt in the TIR chat for a change. Darren, tell us about the first time you heard Van Halen. And then how you subsequently got to interview David Lee Roth.
First time I believe I heard Van Halen was Jump on MTV or VH1, mm-hmm. late 80s. Didn't really pay attention to who the music was, you know, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But at my brother's bar mitzvah, when they hired this lip sync kind of music video company, you mocked, it was called Mock Rock, and you pretended like you were playing the instruments and you could choose a song. And then they, state of the art, 1989, burned the VHS tape for you to take away. And people did Jump. So mm-hmm. I think that was my first wow. But within a couple of years, it was all about Hot for Teacher. And Van Halen ever since has been the deal. One of my favorite bands of all time, if not my favorite. But it's really Dave that I think is the star of Van Halen. Is that, are those fighting words, Jason?
No, I think that's why people have such a hard time dealing with this is much my opinion, the Sammy Hagar era of Van Halen. Because if you pop in any of the first, was it 6 records David Lee Roth does with Van Halen?
Sure.
They're raucous records with these crazy David Lee Roth scatting, talking crap interludes. You know, there's, did you watch the videos? He's doing ninja karate stuff.
Totally.
They just seem like they're having a cokey, boozy, good 80s time. And it's not like Sammy Hagar doesn't come around during the end of the cokey 80s. They're both kind of at the top of their game. I remember Sammy Hagar from I Can't Drive 55. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was that song you couldn't escape when I was a young kid. And then I'm from the Bay Area. You know, he's from the Bay.
Right. That's his home turf. Sorry to interrupt you. But
yeah. That's
why I thought those were fighting words when I said that. Dave.
No. And I've seen Sammy Hagar live. Yeah. I am a person that can say I think OU812 is a great mature rock record, and I think the band Van Halen matures into an adult pop rock success that, you know, sells a gajillion more records, and that's saying a lot because they were selling a lot of records with David Lee Roth. Yeah. But they're no longer kids, it seems like, when David Lee Roth is gone. The kitschiness, the over the topness with the band, you know, definitely takes a back seat. Because also by the time Sammy gets in the band, you know, they're wearing jeans and t-shirts, and they look like they become the dad rock band that, you know, everybody makes fun of them in those years. But
yeah,
we now look at that as a dad look, but they were like, you know, at that time they were probably, you know, sexy rock guys.
Pros and cons to it all. I mean, some, I feel like with Dave that they were calling their own shots, and with Hagar they were letting the stylists call the shots a little more.
Mm-hmm.
They were I didn't know this until a couple days ago. I was watching National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation with my wife and some neighbors, and I didn't realize that the guy who directed Christmas Vacation also directed the, I think it's the When It's Love.
Ooh, okay, yeah.
And that was his first gig. I didn't know that until IMDb. I did some research on that whole thing. So I don't think that there was stylists outside the band in the Dave era where, and I could be wrong about that, but
somebody had to put all that makeup on Eddie Van Halen.
Well, we also see the evolution of Eddie Van Halen because he had that big smile in the 70s and 80s, and he had a kind of a higher voice. And by the time he was, you know, 4 or 5 years into Van Hagar, he's all like, "How you doing, guys?" He kind of had that the smoker's cough.
Yeah, the smoker's voice. There's also a thing where I think the background singing really got to shine in the Sammy Hagar years.
Yeah.
If you, I mean, look, you brought up one of my favorite Van Halen songs, regardless of era, is How Do I Know When It's Love?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful pop song.
Yeah.
And it's the harmonies. And you're just blown away by the harmonies of that song. And it really, to me, the band really goes to another level. Whether or not we want to admit it, because we all want to stay teenagers and have, you know, heavy metal parking lot forever. You know, go back and listen to OU812. It actually is a really good record.
Can I sidebar, by the way? Yeah. Can I throw a million compliments at you in the first one, Jason?
Okay.
Your chatters are great. So your chatters are people who know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 90% knowing what they're talking about, 10% troll. That's a great ratio.
Yeah. You know, sometimes that people on the show are victims of the trolling, but it's all a part of what we do. As my friend reminded me the other day, or reminded me today, said, "Hey, it ain't pouring cement." What do you think makes David Lee Roth the ultimate frontman, Darren?
That he essentially took the best from a lot of different people and merged it his own. So you find a lot of early Van Halen critics that say, hey, he stole everything from Jim Dandy from Black Oak, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And he did take elements from Jim Dandy, but he also made sure, arguably his dad paid for it, but he took some choreography stuff thrown in. I don't know if it's true that they paid a Motown choreographer for some of the Van Halen dance mm-hmm. moves in the early days, but they took that. Jim Dandy's look. So there's soul influences, R&B influence. Dave was never a metal or a hard rock guy. That really came from Eddie and Alex because they were big Black Sabbath fans and Cream and Clapton and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So what made Van Halen great in general is probably the conflict that there were a bunch of guys who liked totally different things, but were able to edit into something totally unique. And, you know, you take a song like Jamie's Crying mm-hmm. and David Lee Roth once, you know, one of his raps on stage was, "This is the rock and roll rumba." And you hear that and you go, that is a rumba. He's totally right about that.
Yeah.
So you get the Latin, the soul, the R&B, the Beach Boys harmonies, etc. And that's what made Van Halen the best, in my humble opinion.
So I have a script and questions and everything that I do for each show. And I was reading the book reading the book. And so then I put it down. I was like, okay, I think I'm prepared to start writing some questions and write the script out. And so I said, you know what? I haven't done in a while. Listen to Van Halen. So as I'm writing the script, I put in my favorite Van Halen. Well, so my favorite song is on a record that I don't think is my favorite Van Halen record, which is Fair Warning.
Okay.
Unchained.
Sure.
That Oakland performance, which, you know, reading in your book, had some overdubs. But
video overdubs too.
Oh man, when I found out that Eddie Van Halen detuned to drop D flat, I changed all my guitars at that time. I was like, all right, everything is drop D flat. That's how we're gonna play for years until I, you know, went to drop retarded. But I'm listening to that, and I was like, well, let me go back and listen to some Dave solo stuff. So I literally started from the first EP.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, ooh. So do you think he was booted out of Van Halen, or do you think he left? Or do you think it was a cocaine-fueled combination of both?
Anytime you use the word cocaine, say allegedly.
Oh, okay. Allegedly. Allegedly was like, cocaine!
Because there was some stuff along, and that was a great Queens of the Stone Age reference that you just put in there. So kudos to you on knowing your stuff, Jason. But I think that Dave was booted because of that whole. Let me backtrack. People say April 1st, 1985, Dave was kicked out of Van Halen. That's not true. That's just some misprint that's been misprinted into oblivion. So some of the facts get a little bit fuzzy. But what we do know is that Dave had a deal to do a movie through CBS Studios. And Dave had that EP out, Crazy from the Heat, while he was still in Van Halen. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, Eddie was steamed at the idea of Dave asking him for time off to do the movie and asking him to compose or contribute to that soundtrack. Now, where that gets a little crazy is that Eddie has said in interviews around that time, you know, the nerve of that guy to want to work on stuff outside of Van Halen.
But by that,
by that point in time, Eddie was on a Nicolette Sheridan, I think that's her name. No, Nicolette Larson album that Ted Templeman did. Mm-hmm. He played on Beat It on Thriller. He scored a TV movie for Valerie Bertinelli, and he scored that unofficial Fast Time at Ridgemont High sequel. I think it's called The Wildlife. So Eddie was allowed to do anything he wanted, and then Dave wanted to do one thing, and that was the last straw somehow.
In reading that, I'm reading it, and I'm thinking to myself, was it a misunderstanding? Did it become one of those things where they became so big, they had rival camps, they had people in each other's ears?
Sure.
You know, Eddie Van Halen plays 15 minutes of a solo, you know, recording time, for Michael Jackson's Beat It, which becomes the biggest record the world has ever known. Maybe he thinks that whatever he touches, A, he doesn't need to take that much time to do it because he's Eddie Van Halen, right? I'm Eddie Van Halen. I just show up and do it. I've heard so many, not horror stories, but stories about him actually being extremely nonchalant. Like one of the best stories I heard about Eddie Van Halen was picking up a guitar from a luthier. He pulls up in one of his ridiculously expensive Eddie Van Halen cars.
Yeah.
And this guitar is one of a kind. It's one of his that he put. He's like, hey, we made it to your specs exactly, Eddie. Here's the penny and the bridge that you put in there. And he's like, hey, man, thanks. Takes it and throws it in the front seat and takes off. Like, no case. He just throws the guitar in the car and just takes off. Like, just doesn't care. Maybe Eddie Van Halen is just so nonchalant about certain things that he thinks Dave takes too much because he can't see. Kind of that James Hetfield thing, like he's worked on so many other projects outside of Metallica before Jason Newsted left.
Oh yeah, you raise a really good point, which I don't mention in the book, but you clearly know, which is that one of the points of contention that Jason Newsted had when he was in Metallica was there was a Metallica policy of you can't be on anyone else's record. And then Neustadt would go, but you're on, James, you're on every corrosion of conformity thing. Yep. You're allowed to do whatever you want, and I can't be on one thing. I think he was on that Uncle album, the one that had the Tom York duet. But some bands have that weird policy.
I didn't know that. I just found out James Hetfield's on the first Danzig record.
He is?
Yeah, he's singing background vocals.
Oh, that would check out, because the 6 degrees of Rick Rubin with Danzig being on American and... Mm-hmm.
They were all cool. I didn't know that. And so again, I think some of these guys get a little blinded by what they feel they can do chilling and what they see other members doing. So yeah. And I mean, come on, it's David Lee Roth. I really can't see him being the guy that thinks like you're not going to tie me down.
I think it kind of goes both ways. One of the things that the book kind of goes into is where the David Lee Roth, Diamond Dave split, where the character ended and the human being started was very, very clear before he was famous. Mm-hmm. But over the years, he really became that character, almost like Dice Clay, that is inhabited Andrew Clay Silverstein. Uh-huh. So with Dave, you just don't know what he's going to be easygoing about and what he's going to be a control freak about. Because if you speak to 10 people who ran into him, you'll hear the most generous, kind thing ever. Oh, he adopted a bunch of puppies. Oh, he bought everyone food. You'll hear that kind of stuff. And then you'll talk to people who played in his band and you'll go, he was telling me to play on the other side of the guitar neck. I think I have that in the book. I didn't leave that out. But Rock'em Shot, who played with Dave, mm-hmm. also played on the score to the TV show Friends. He's legit. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, Dave was looking at my playing and going, yeah, play that an octave up or play that on the other side of the guitar. And he's going, what? because I think Dave is more of a visual guy than he is an audio guy.
That's what we say about producers.
Yeah. Casting couch or not, that's what you
said. Yeah, right. Like, oh, can you play it on the other side of the neck? I don't know what you mean.
So, somebody in your chat said, dude in the Rembrandts. Your chatters know so much.
Look, you're on TIR, man. MFers aren't messing around here. They knew we were talking about David Lee Roth. Someone says, is Glenn Danzig Nazi adjacent? I don't know. I actually stayed with the dude that toured with him and said that he is the nicest man ever to the opening bands and is a horrible person to crew. So
yes. Yeah. With Danzig, I think it's that professional wrestling influence. And I can say the same thing for Dave, where do you know when I say kayfabe, what
I'm talking about? I'm making a documentary called Kayfabe. Yep.
Oh, I am psyched for that. I want to see that if I can help you with that, etc. But one of the people I spoke to, and I think I left this out of the book, told me that Dave, when you're one-on-one with him, is a real dude. And the second there's that extra person in the room, he becomes Diamond Dave. I think with a lot of wrestlers, they're trained to be that. I think with Danzig, you're expecting to see gloom and doom Glenn. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to see a guy who likes hot dogs and hamburgers and all that kind of stuff. That Glenn's ex-girlfriend that he was serious for a while. Did you ever see the photos on Instagram of her, him, their friend, their couple friends going for a hike?
You're like what?
You don't want to think of Glenn Danzig hiking, but obviously he does like hiking.
It goes into like creating a character. I don't know if you agree with this. Okay. I feel like these guys that definitely exist in the, and I would love to hear what the chat has to say about this, because I feel like a lot of people that are watching this show right now are people that grew up in the MTV era, in the movie star era, before social media. And I'm not saying this as a diss to younger generations, and I'm not saying this as a diss to social media. It's just we have a different frame of reference, especially when it comes to celebrity. When you mention kayfabe and people like Glenn Danzig and even David Lee Roth, like, they could stay superstars that ascend forever, and we never knew about their personal life. You know, you only knew the little bits that you could get out of like magazines. And even then, I don't know if we were that concerned about their personal life. It was the magazines would give you gossip about the record and when it was coming out, or a video was coming out, or they're going to do this new thing that was going to happen. And the Glenn Danzigs and the David Lee Ross of the world, you know, insert, you know, whatever superstar, whatever genre of music, Miles Davis, even, yeah. You know, we didn't know all this about people's personal lives. And I don't know if having a certain window into the mundane banality of Beyonce is really what I want to see. You know, I got to be there at that Coachella. I was working the Coachella. She was there.
Sure.
And it was an event. I'm not a huge Beyonce fan, but I will always give props to somebody that puts on a show. That was an event. And Eminem had to follow up.
Yeah.
The next night. And that was an event. You know, and I don't want to know about... You know, them yelling at their kids in the morning. And
I personally do, for the record. And can I totally hijack the conversation?
Please.
And ask if you know about something, because you know stuff. And okay. I've never encountered anyone who's heard this rumor before. Okay. It's not about Roth.
Okay.
So I'm taking that you're a Prince Paisley Park fan.
Yes.
Okay. Have you ever heard the rumor that Prince around the time of his passing or shortly before was making a documentary about Coco Beware?
I've never heard that. I've heard so many Prince stories. I've heard Prince stories from people that were in the room with him. I've heard Prince stories from techs that worked for him. I've heard Prince stories from musical directors. I've heard Prince stories from people in Larry Graham's band.
Oh.
I've never heard that he was making a documentary on Coco Beware. Please tell me more.
Supposedly, when they were going through his stuff and figuring out what was left over, a credible person said that there was an unfinished documentary about Coco Beware. And I don't know if there's any connection to Morris Day and the bird and Coco Beware being the Birdman, but that's just me being extra conspiracy theory on top.
Is he from Minnesota?
No, he was a Memphis guy, Coco.
Huh.
Is a man, still is there.
Prince is an odd cat, man. And the stories I've heard about him are, I don't want to say uneven. They're pretty rock starish.
Just know? Like Dave, and believe it or not, shared a tour manager.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Also, they were both Warner Brother artists in the same peak. Like 1984 was around the same time as Purple Rain. Mm. So they were probably yelling at the same lawyers for wanting more advertising and promotional funds.
That explains the movie. That explains the David Lee Roth movie.
Didn't they both date Apollonia, or is it?
Didn't they? I don't look. She's not here to defend herself.
I thought it was Dave.
I don't want to sully the name of a queen.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful lady.
Did you interview Apollonia?
I wish. I didn't get her. I've gotten some people from the Revolution.
Oh, wow.
Not Apollonia. And I thought it was that Dave was dating her, and Prince publicly was making it look like he was dating her, which is kayfabe-ish. And then Dave wasn't allowed to be publicly with her at Prince's wishes. Ever heard that before?
It sounds about right. Did you read Sheila E.'s book about Prince?
No, but tell me more.
Sheila E.
Yeah.
Was not all that kind. She wasn't mean. You know, she definitely, you know, Prince, I wouldn't say made her. Her last name makes her, but.
Yeah, Escobedo, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But. That dude seemed very kayfabe-ish. I think he had proposed to her like on stage, right? Like they were dating, and then would just go off and just bang. Like, well, that was for the stage. Like, you know what I mean? Like he was not, she does not speak about him. I don't know. She, as a musician and a band person, I guess he was cool as a person to date. He seemed like a goddamn nightmare.
You just throw out those disclaimers a few more times. That Prince estate is probably not very easy to deal with.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think they are easy to deal with because as soon as he died, he's all over Chase card commercials and Let's Go Crazy as you charge in your card. I'm sure Prince is like,
yeah,
but curse the hell out of his estate.
But I'll tell you one thing that I like more about Prince than I do Roth is that Ross didn't keep long-term tabs on his sidemen. He didn't super endorse them. And the way that you look at Prince's long-term relationships with, say, Liv Warfield and Andy Allo, who stars in Upload on Amazon Prime, and even the Revolution people and Michael Bland, he kept tabs. You know, sometimes they popped up on stage. Larry Graham was around for a long time. Chaka Khan was. And you didn't really see those people coming around for David Lee Roth years later. You didn't see Steve Vai cameos and that kind of thing.
No, and I think that says a lot about the person when you burn certain bridges. Like, I understand we all get busy. I mean, I'm sure there's people that helped you when you were, you know, trying to figure out how to work a camcorder in, you know, the early 90s. And maybe now you don't talk to them as much because you guys got families and moved and da-da-da-da. Like, I get that to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But to your point, there's something to be said about guys like Prince. Like, in being in the studio that I lived in for so long in West Oakland, you don't know this. I lived in a music rehearsal recording studio in West Oakland.
Hey, let's go down the list of the greats besides you who did that, who lived in the studio. It's like you, Alice in Chains. Like, it happens. It's a phase of your career when you're like, oh, well, I work here all day. There's a bed. It's cheaper. I might as well live here.
You know, these rats, you know, we can fight them off with bats and small guns.
Metallica did that too.
This was a place actually Metallica had done some rehearsal at back in the day. Yeah, so all the Bay Area metal guys were there.
All the punk guys were there.
Yes. Actually, my book launch party, Rick Hunolt from Exodus, Craig LoCicero from Forbidden was there, and Chris Kontos from Machine Head was there. These are all people that I hung out with forever. Sadly, Ted from Flipper couldn't come because he was ill, but I name a genre of music and those people were there. And one thing I did appreciated about seeing stuff like that was a certain amount of camaraderie. That if somebody that hadn't really been around was in the studio, everybody came out to say what's up. And I always thought that was cool, and that really speaks to A, the scene you're a part of, and B, the kind of cat you are that, you know, when people find out you're in town, everybody wants to say what's up. And you also found out like who wasn't cool, like the guys that get kicked out of certain bands and no one wants to have anything to do with them. You're like, man, that guy must have been a real scumbag. But in seeing all these groups and then like things that would happen, you know, musicians that we think make tons of money, maybe they make decent money at a certain point in time in their career, and then that thing they do falls out of favor, and then they go off and be regular cats, and there's an adjustment period, and not everybody handles that adjustment period well, and sometimes you're just not where you want to be financially. And there were people that had gotten ill in the metal scene. And I would see these guys all the time when they would find out one of their boys was like ill. It was like, oh, fundraiser.
Yeah.
Got to do a fundraiser for so-and-so. And the way into my room was there was a big stage room that larger bands would use to rehearse for like tours and stuff. And so there was this one day I walked in and I had no idea there was a fundraiser going on. And literally every band from the 80s is in that, you know, Death Angel, Mordred, the Exodus guys, all the Testament guys, Violence guys, because it was for the singer of Violence, like everybody
is just
in the room and they're practicing different songs, getting ready to do a fundraiser because one cat was ill. And I think that, again, that speaks to, you know, a decent individual and a good scene.
Yeah. Well, full circle to rudely interrupt you for the eighth time right here, Jason. That's kind of kayfabe in a way, because you look at metal, which is this gruff exterior, where it's about being macho and tough and all that. And then you find out that most of the metal guys not only do not listen to metal when they're off stage, they listen to jazz and other stuff, but they're sweet, laughing teddy bears. Like Tom Araya from Slayer cannot frown. He is a
I've heard good things about Tom.
He's a church-going smiley dude.
I've heard nothing but good things about Tom.
And then you flip the other way around, and with David Lee Roth, who's singing all these songs that are about partying and all that, that smile is not usually there in everyday life. Of course, you can think about plenty of examples where, oh, Darren is totally wrong about that. But it's generally, I find, the angrier the music, the happier the people are in everyday life, and the flip side, vice versa. Just like the bad guys in wrestling are generally the nicest human beings on earth, as long as they don't have to keep up the character 24/7.
Does the character consume you, right? And here's taking it back to the one of the questions that I prepared.
Oh,
in your book, and I'm going to totally paraphrase. there's a quote from someone, I can't remember, they were like a manager, I think. They said they didn't follow Van Halen after the departure of Van Halen, after the departure of Roth, because they felt the band got too poppy. And they said David Lee Roth's circus-like atmosphere, again, I'm paraphrasing, made the band fun, but Dave's stuff was a little too over the top. And when I read that, I had highlighted it, and I was like, oh man, this is good. Because then when I go back and listen to David Lee Roth's solo stuff, it sounds like the antithesis of what you described that made Van Halen great, some of it. It's the cuffs are off David Lee Roth, and he can totally be the ringmaster of the circus. And we don't have to get too into his radio career. But
I will happily talk about the radio career all damn day.
I mean,
whatever you want, Jason. We talk
that to me you. Kind of felt like his radio career, because it's like I can't sit here every day, and people are probably going to complain. You do tell a lot of stories about the road. F you. I did it. God damn it. Yeah. But seriously, I can't sit here and tell tour stories all the time, because A, it's going to get redundant. B, tell the same one a million times. And C, you don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that. Can you throw in some good ones here and there if you're David Lee Roth? I'm sure you can. But at a certain point, how many shows are you really playing when you're Van Halen? Like, let's just be honest. When you're doing arenas like that, you're not doing, you know, I think you said one year they did like 100 shows in a year.
Yeah, they did have their prolific touring eras. They obviously scaled back for the reunion stuff. If you go back to the early days when Dave says we played 5 40-minute sets a night.
Oh, that's the cover band days, and you're playing in town. You know, when I was touring as a broke wannabe, we were doing 6 to 9 months a year, 100 to 150 shows a year. That's a lot. And I'm not talking all local. We're going to drive to the other side of town. I'm talking you get in the car, bring your passport, you know, you're going to go to some different countries. You're going to get tired of seeing trees. Everything, right? There's only so many things that pop out into your brain at a certain point, because it does become redundant. You know, like I don't remember the 15th show I played in Arizona. There might be a story there that's pretty funny. I just don't remember it.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. Usually the first and second show you remember easily. The last few you do, if somebody came on stage, if there was a prank from another band, if there was one of your heroes was in the crowd, if you met somebody, you remember that kind of stuff. In the case of Van Halen, it was weirdly the same show every night.
Yeah.
But how do I explain this? Okay, the first time, first time I saw David Lee Roth live, I went, this is the best show I've ever seen. And a couple months later, I saw that same show in a different city. And I went, that was the greatest show. I need to see it again. I go, that was the exact same show I saw. It was still great. And a couple months later, I saw it again in another city. And I went, okay, this is exactly the same exact show I've seen. It's okay. And then I saw it a fourth time and I went, this is a lot. This is a lot to deal with. But when I say it's the same exact show, I mean, I saw David Lee Roth in Japan live and he was talking in Spanish to the crowd. I mean, it's the same exact show. When he yells into the audience, but you don't look like Beyonce, you go like, I don't think they understand what you're talking about when you're saying that. But good on Dave, you know?
You know, yeah. Once you start having the same things and you're like, okay, this is the point in the show. We're going to do this thing and we're going to just change this. And
well, look at all the people here tonight. You know?
Yeah, like you can't. The only things you start to remember are like the worst things that have ever happened in your life. Like someone asked me, I live here in Mexico and I was out on a date last night.
Sure.
And the person I was out with was born in a city that they had never been to, but it's a city that I played tons of shows in, a very violent city at the time. And they were asking me about what the city was like. And it started me telling all these stories about my first time there that I totally forgot. And I'm like, that's like, I even tell them the stories, like, I can't believe that all that happened. Like, we were in a house and this woman was naked with a knife, and then this happened. Like, Jesus Christ, like, all this stuff happened.
Which city in Mexico? You got to tell me that.
Yeah, we were in Juarez. We were in Juarez.
So, you walked across the border from El Paso into Juarez?
I'll be brief because I know you don't want to be up all night. And I'll do my David Lee Roth impersonation and tell you a funny story. So we had left our booking agent, who to this day is our booking agent, is for the live shows that we do. Me and Ben Burgess and Matt Leck and David Griscom. Mm-hmm. We have the same booking agent that I had as a when I did a band with my ex called La Fin Absolute du Monde. And for some reason we met this dude and he just told us all the things that we wanted to hear. And that happens when you want to be somebody, right? There's always some cat in your ear that's like, oh my God, I got a hold of your music and this is the greatest thing I've ever heard.
I gave you that cough, by the way.
That was me.
Yeah.
And I gave it to Ian MacKay and he said, this is great, but he only signs DC bands. So you're going to be the next great big, you know, minor threat type thing. And I'm like, I don't even understand why you're saying that, because we don't even sound like that, but whatever. Mm-hmm. And he had booked this tour for us in the Southwest and we were supposed to play Juarez. And he told us, we played El Paso. We were supposed to do a couple shows in El Paso. And so we played the first night in El Paso and the promoter that night was supposed to drive us into Juarez like a few days later. And so at the end of the show, he pays us out. He's like, dude, that was great. That was awesome. Everything's great. Awesome. And we're like, you're driving us to Juarez, right? And dude looks at us and goes, oh no, I'm not taking you there. People die down there. And we're like, okay. He goes, oh, the guy you're staying with tomorrow night, he's going to take you to Juarez. Don't worry. So we go to this guy's house. We stay with this guy. And sadly, his mom, I think, was like bipolar. And this is a Mexican cat. And so we're at the dinner table and we go, and I'm not going to say his name. And we go, hey, are you taking us to Juarez? He goes, oh no, I'm not taking you to Juarez. He goes, people die down there. And his dad just stops. And his dad goes, are these guys trying to go to Juarez? And we're like, yeah, we're supposed to play a show in Juarez. Like, what's the big deal? And he goes, you guys seem like good people. Do you understand that they kill everybody in one bar just to get to one guy? He goes, you're not going to go to Juarez. He goes, my son's not taking to Juarez. He's like, no, you're not going to Juarez. And so that night, the guy's mom had an episode. And she like ran out. We were sleeping, like crashing on their living room couch. And she like ran out with a with a knife and no pants on.
Oh, okay.
And was like screaming. But that was the second time in that year that we were staying in someone's place and there was a woman screaming with a knife.
And no pants?
The first time was in the UK. That woman did have clothes on, but she did slice up her boyfriend a little bit. So we were like, what are we doing wrong with our lives? So eventually we did get into to Juarez and played the show, but we had to cancel one show. And then there were all these comments in Spanish yelling at us. And a kid that was a photographer for a magazine in Juarez ended up picking us up in El Paso, mm-hmm. driving us in. And we, after that, we played Juarez a F ton of times. And then we ended up doing tours in Mexico City and stuff like that. So it was great, but it was a very, very different atmosphere than what I see here in this part of Mexico. But yeah.
I have a positive Juarez experience, yeah. which is that back in like 4 or 5 months ago, I did a press trip to El Paso, Texas, and everyone was saying, "Oh, El Paso's dangerous. The streets are flooded with migrants. It's dangerous. You can't do anything." And we get down there, and there was none of that.
No, it's so safe.
Was yeah. totally a lie. And you know, one of our hosts or chaperones goes, if you want to go to Juarez, I'll make a call." And we went, "We can go to Juarez?" And she's like, "Yeah, totally." So we went to Kentucky Bar. Did you ever go over there?
Mm-mm. What year was this? Do you remember?
2023.
Oh, you went recently. I haven't been back to Juarez since 2016.
Oh, okay. Well, it was totally fine. That is where the margarita was supposedly invented.
Oh, no shit.
They have under the bar these trough looking things, because possibly that's where people used to go to the bathroom instead of going to the bathroom elsewhere. The one David Lee Roth thing I was going to do, but I didn't get to do, they had a digital jukebox. So I was going to see if their jukebox had Sonrisa Salvaje on it, but it wouldn't work with my phone, unfortunately. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Sonrisa Salvaje? Yeah, the Spanish version of
Eat 'em. Bless you, Jason.
Yeah.
I could not.
No, when I was there, when we played that show there, so the band I was in, La Fina Sur Duran, was just me and my ex, my woman I was married to. And she went to the bathroom. We finally got to the venue, and venues out there, it was gnarly, dude. It was like a weird brothel on the bottom, and then upstairs would be like where the show was. And so, you know, we got there early, you got to load in or whatever. And so she goes to the bathroom, and the kid that brought us in, he's like, "Jason, where's Cindy?" I was like, "Oh, she's in the bathroom." He goes, "You should check and make sure she's there." I was like, "Make sure she, like, what?" Like, that's, I had never had anybody say that at any point. Like, "Oh, you make sure she's there." Like, you know, he's like, "Hey, you know where you are."
Exact opposite in Kentucky Bar, because they called ahead and said that these gringo tourists were coming. The owner or one of the owners came up to me like after the second or third drink, and they are strong drinks over there in a good way. And he goes, "You are our guests. You are safe here." Like, wait, was I ever not?
Yeah, when people say stuff like that, you're like, "Wait, why should I be worried?"
Oh, like, but I love it. I hope to go back to El Paso and Juarez, it shows that it's a rock town. Actually,
yes.
The El Paso Juarez thing is in the book because that happened on the 88 Dave tour. Mm-hmm. But I think the Motley Crue Def Leppard tour did El Paso. So if that doesn't say it's a rock town, I don't know what
it's
does.
El Paso is a hell of a rock town, and Juarez and Mexico City are some amazing rock and metal scenes. Again, some of the best shows I've ever done were there. The last time we played there, two things I remember very vividly. The room was packed, and that was weird, and people knew us, and we were like jazzed. And then they're like, fans were helping us load out. And then I remember some dude was banging somebody like right, not on our van, but like, just too close to it.
Like, well, so you're going to remember that date of the tour.
That's one of those things like you're like, okay, I'm not in Kansas anymore. All right, let's get our stuff. Let's go home.
Oh, but going back to something that one of your chatters wrote before, I didn't mean to come across that Eddie was a prima donna. It's kind of the opposite. I think Eddie and Dave are kind of the same in that you hear the nicest of the nice, the worst of the worst stories interchangeably. And you always have to consider the source. And I think they're two people who just like, this is what they felt like doing at that exact second. So they did it. They had the means to do it, the resources, the time. So they did it and then did not think about it again. But you think, like, I ran into Eddie at Ralph's supermarket, and the rest of your life you tell that story. And to Eddie, it was just like, yeah, I was getting chips at 10 in the morning. So I think that a lot of these stories with Prince and Axl Rose and Dave and these larger than life characters, you're the coolest of the cool, the worst of the worst, sometimes from the same people.
That's a really good point. You know, I met
every James now and then. I have one of those, not often, but sometimes.
I met James Hetfield when I was 12 years old at a Sizzler in Pinole, California. I had just dubbed for my very good friend Paul Mendoza. Let me dub "And Justice for All." Mm-hmm. I just dubbed it, and my mom. It was the one time my mom let me go get my own food. You know, I was like a kid.
Yeah.
I don't know if they have Sizzler where you're from.
Oh yeah, we lost Sizzler like 15 years ago, but I think it's still around in Japan, and I kid not. I went to a Sizzler 10-ish years ago in Japan.
There's a sick part of me that misses Sizzler.
I do too.
But I went I'm going up with my little kid plate trying to make my dream salad. I bumped into this thing in front of me, and that thing was James Hetfield. And he turned around to see what hit him. And he saw me, and I was scared because I was like, oh my God, he knows I dubbed the tape. That was like my first thought, like, he knows. There's all the warnings on it. But he laughed, and I thought he was like a decent cat, and he just kept looking back. He was with a woman at the time, and they would look, and he was like, oh yeah, that's the kid that fucking bumped into me, looked all scared. He just thought it was funny. But I've heard like horrible stories about James Hetfield. It's like, dude, I've
never heard one negative James Hetfield story. I'm thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I've never heard one. I'm not like gonna go, hey, tell me some. But I was thinking about it. I've only heard smiley James Hetfield stories.
I've heard some tales. I ran into him one time. He seemed like a decent cat.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the only – I've ran into Jason Newsted before.
Yeah.
Cool dude. Super cool dude. But back to David Lee Roth.
Yeah. And by the way, one of our chatters just mentioned Aldo Nova. I have an Aldo Nova quote in this book.
Mm-hmm.
I randomly interviewed Aldo like a year ago. And I just pumped him for a Van Halen quote, because anytime you just say Van Halen in an article, magically 200% more people see it.
We'll see if 200% more people watch tonight. You talk about Steve Vai.
Yeah.
I love Steve Vai because my first introduction into Steve Vai was the movie Crossroads with Ralph Macchio.
Yeah.
And so I always saw Steve Vai as Satan's guitar player. And he goes and joins David Lee Roth's band. As I'm re-listening to the David Lee Roth solo stuff, it does feel a little Van Halen-y in a certain sense, tonally. Steve Vai is very different from Eddie Van Halen. And he played with Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa, session work with Public Image Limited.
I didn't know he did session work with them.
Or at least played on one thing, and that was part of how he saved up money to build his own studio doing session work.
He's like a serious musician, right? And I think probably didn't dig all the crazy David Lee Roth stuff to a certain extent. And a guy that's actually from my city ends up joining the band, Jason Becker.
Yes.
He's actually from Richmond, California. He went to Kennedy High in Richmond. He's one of the most beloved people in the city to this day, even though he's very, very ill with ALS. But maybe you don't know, he's written several records since his
with eye movement.
With eye movement, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Anytime you don't feel like getting out of bed in the morning, you just gotta think, well, Jason Becker has made more albums than I have. Look at what
An opera? It was an opera he wrote. He's an insanely talented young man. Well, now he's an older man.
Yeah, he's probably close to 60, right?
He was young.
Because, yeah, when he got into Roth's band, I think he was an early 20s hotshot. Yeah. But then you go, Little Ain't Enough was 1991, so.
Yeah, so, yeah, he should be 50s, 50-something. He just had a birthday recently, and I can't remember how old he turned. Maybe he was 55. But
I can't drive that, though.
You can't drive that, you said? Do you think David Lee Roth's band would have been different had Jason Becker not gotten sick?
No, unpopular opinion here. I love the title track or the lead single on A Little Ain't Enough. Mm-hmm. I don't love the whole album. And the reason why is because the writing style and all that changed. Mm-hmm. One of the things that this book digs into, which isn't a flattering thing for Dave, is it's questionable how much of that album he actually wrote. It comes allegedly, a lot of the songs on that album were written by other people, and then he just kind of rearranged and changed or added words. So there were finished songs to an extent. Mm-hmm. So I think at that point in time, Dave, he wasn't as hungry as he was with Eat 'Em and Smile or Skyscraper. Then if you look at the tour itself, it's not like he was really showcasing his band. In fact, most people don't realize who was in his band at that era. It was Joe, who later played with Ozzy. There was a second guitarist for some of the tour. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the bassist who played on the record. Brett Tuggle and Greg Bissonette were still there, but it's not like Dave was going, this is my band. It's just, this is the Dave tour. And sales were weak, and a lot of the shows got canceled on that run. It didn't really go around the world like the prior to the prior tour for Skyscraper did.
That's sad. Jason Becker is a mind-blowing guitarist, and the things he was doing, you know, even before he graduated high school, was next level. That's why, you know, Eddie was like, this is going to be the next dude.
Yeah, I mean, let's look at the history of like guitar greats. Mm. You could play a trillion notes, but the question is, are there songs connected to it?
Yes.
So why does Eric Clapton have the staying power? Arguably, and this is just an on-the-spot theory here, but if he didn't have Wonderful Tonight, we probably wouldn't be talking about him all these decades later. If he didn't have the MTV Unplugged with Layla, you kind of needed the ballads, which were less about the guitar playing, to make the person stand out. Otherwise, you know, we're not talking about Eric Sardinas so much or Eric Gales, those kind of people who are better than everybody. I'm still waiting for Joe Bonamassa to have that hit that crosses him over. Mm-hmm. And until you have that, you're just a really, really, really talented, flashy kind of person, and you're going to be stuck at the theater level.
Mm.
So I find that with Vi, the fact that they had Yankee Rose under him and just like Paradise, that's why he could kind of elevate beyond just being a guitar god. You can disagree with me. You could totally tell me I'm wrong about that.
I do. Just like Paradise had me lip syncing all over my mom's little bitty.
Still does.
That song. I hadn't listened to that song probably in 30 years. And I was driving down the road to drop off my laundry before I take off on this journey. And that song came on, and I was just transmitted to being a little kid watching it on those old floor model TVs with a cable box with the knob on there that you got to turn, you know.
It holds up. I mean, the production on Just Like Paradise sucks because it's a keyboard bass. Mm-hmm. It's clearly a drum machine or drum programming. Mm-hmm. It's a very poor production, but the chorus, if I were much younger, I would say slaps.
Don't say that.
But okay. I'm not young and cool, so I don't say things like laps.
But look, I listening to that and listening to Vi's soloing,
yeah,
like, man, this is great. And again, I'm going through every Roth solo record, and they just felt uneven.
100% agreed. I'm not going to fight you on that, except for Eat 'Em and Smile.
Eat 'Em and Smile is so. What's funny is there's this great burger place here in Rosarito. It's one of the best burgers I've ever had in North America. And as a person that's been around North America entirely too many times, that's saying something. And the guy that owns it is from LA, and he's a rocker dude. And I told him I was doing this show tonight, and he was all excited. And we were talking about David Lee Roth, and he goes, "Didn't like the one where he's on the rock. Didn't like that, but Eat 'Em and Smile." He goes, "That's a good record, but the rock, eh." He makes his face. He goes, "Eh, didn't like that."
I love Skyscraper, but that's a known that some of it is absolute garbage.
Like, it is so uneven. It is so uneven sonically. I'm not one of those cinephile. I'm not one of those people that is like, I don't know what you call it, where you're just such a jerk about sounds. Like, oh no, the tone's a little off.
Audiophile.
Yeah. I am not that guy. I'm definitely like, it's got distortion. Let's go. Right. You know, people recording with me might differ, but full of crap. But, and I have stock regular system in my car. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be pretty bad for me to hear the difference. If you listen to Paradise, and I'm just listening on Spotify, the next song is like 12 decibels lower. And I was like, I'm like, does something happen? No, it's just that badly mastered or not mastered at all.
You're not wrong about that. And if you look at all the layered production and just like Paradise, it seems like they spent all the time on the talking background tracks mm-hmm. and hidden messages in that song. Mm-hmm. Like all the, that's it, that's it. All these buried weird things that are going on in that song. Mm-hmm. There's a lot hidden in there. And then you listen to the piece of crap that's Two Fools a Minute. You go, who is that for?
And I'm like, what is... First of all, why is it so? And I was like, oh, it's one of those things we're just going to like the gradual, right? I do that. I think I'm going to gradually shift it. You know, no, it's just recorded that badly. If I'm lying, someone put in Skyscraper, play Paradise, and tell me the song following it isn't like at least 10 decibels lower. Insane.
Part of it might be that I think they tracked it at seven to 10 different studios, and it was one of the first records to use digital recording, which you can imagine how state-of-the-art 1988 digital recording is.
Look.
But
look, as someone that literally recorded an album while they were homeless.
Yeah.
In a gajillion different spots, sometimes with what we could put together. I listened to that record recently, and me personally, I'm like, oh yeah, that's the thing that we did at the end that we shouldn't have done. But I know it because I was there, right?
Yeah.
Does the listener know it? I read the reviews for it, and the reviews weren't like, oh, it sounds like it was recorded at 18 different places. Were these motherfuckers homeless? Like, that's not, there's no excuse at that level. Kind of you to make it, but that's not how mastering works.
But don't get me wrong. I own, I think, 4 copies of Skyscraper on vinyl. It just became a joke because one time I was baked out of my mind at 2 a.m. and I bought it on vinyl, forgetting that I had it. I think I did that twice. That doesn't mean I love the album, but I love Skyscraper. And I think, did you see that 30 Seconds to Mars? Jared Leto rock climbing thing to announce their latest world tour, that he was trying to scale the Empire State Building here in New York.
I saw something about that and I didn't think it was real.
It was real. It was real to whatever real that you believe Jared Leto is real. I don't know how real allegedly it is, but come on, he stole that from Dave. It's just one of those things where you go, Dave's legacy is still living on, whether or not people want to realize it or people like the Skyscraper record.
It's weird because there's only been a handful of places I've ever been and people are playing David Lee Roth solo stuff.
My apartment.
right? Like your
bar I'm at.
David Lee Roth's house, you know.
Friends antagonizing me. yeah, those places.
Now, I remember we were playing in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the name of the venue, but it was a really cool little venue not too far from the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And they were playing, if not Skyscraper, I think they're playing Eat 'Em and Smile.
Okay.
They you know, it's one of those things where like, hey, we got a record player in between bands, we're going to play a record. And I was like, that's interesting. Like, I forgot all about this record. And we were talking about David Lee Roth. And, you know, this guy was one of those people that knew all about the other players, you know, the Billy Sheehan and the Bassinets and, you know, all these other people that played on those records. And we were having a conversation about musicians and da 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 da. And that was like the last time I can remember having a David Lee Roth conversation. Now, all those metal dudes, people in my band, even on the last tour we were on, it doesn't take much for us to start yelling about Van Halen records. Doesn't take much.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll start yelling about even Sammy Hagar era Van Halen records that we like. And I sing now, so the two guitar players will start yelling about, you know, Eddie's chain of pedals, or which he didn't really have too many, or the different amps he was using in different eras, and da 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 da. But you know, you don't really get too many David Lee Roth discussions. So I want to thank you for hitting me up so we can have this David Lee Roth discussion, because you brought up something that I didn't put two and two together, which is Prince gets his movie deal, which he fights for. Remember, they tell him, Prince, you've never directed a frickin' music video, and you want to write a movie?
Right.
And he's like, yes. And he has the number one album and the number one movie. No one's ever going to do that again. No one's going to do that again. No. There's no one. Who's going to do that?
Spice Girls. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Justin to Kelly.
No one's going to do that again. There's no one that has that kind of, that's not even star power. That's just that cat.
Yeah.
But David Lee Roth tries to do it. And can you tell us a little bit about that? Because he actually writes a script. I think they're even principal photography is done. They're ready to shoot. And then CBS Pictures goes under.
Yeah. They had a string of flops and just closed house. And so it was totally announced that Dave's movie called Crazy from the Heat was happening. Mm-hmm. They casted for it. They did wardrobe. One of the things we talk about in the book is I was tipped off to this by Dave Jellison. He was the original or one of the first bassists in the band Rat. And he's since become a huge director of commercials and ad agency kind of things. Legendary guy. And he was around Van Halen, I think the 82 tour through the end of Van Halen with Roth, and then he helped design the Skyscraper tour. So I think he was in Roth's orbit 5-6 years,
mm-hmm.
really worked closely with him. He was supposed to be an assistant director on Crazy from the Heat. So I sourced some information from him, some from a character actor / comic Sam Ingrafia, who just came out with a book. He, sidebar.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Piscopo did this really horrible HBO special.
I remember it, and I'm very excited you're telling the story.
Mm-hmm. Did his rap on it. Mm-hmm. Look up Joe Piscopo's rap.
Don't look it up, people.
It is one of the most cancel culture friendly things ever. It's when somebody thinks what hip hop is. Okay, I won't.
Joe, when you write about Joe Piscopo, I was expecting Joe Piscopo to be a big player in this book because I figured he'd be a David Lee Roth guy.
I thought so too. He ignored all of my interview requests. So
of all people that needs all the press, Piscopo, come on, man.
I really look forward to hearing what you think about Piscopo's rap.
I vaguely remember that, but Joe Piscopo forever is going to do the funniest Frank Sinatra of the "You're as blind as a bat and I have sight." That was groovy thinking, Lincoln. When now, you set them free.
I'm amazed you could just pull that off. Now, I think that Piscopo is very talented, but mm-hmm. he's kind of like Roth, where he learns how to do the most basic elementary trick of any one thing. Mm-hmm. And then he doesn't master for the, he just moves on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So it's like we see him sing, do stand up, play the drums, dance, rap. It's like a high school talent show as an HBO special. So going back to what I was talking
about. And it was him. Look, not to, people are like, we wanted to hear about David Lee Roth. Stop talking about Joe Piscopo.
Okay. Well, I was looking up.
We're going to talk about Joe Piscopo. Joe Piscopo is part of that Saturday Night Live, that weird era of Saturday Night Live.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And Eddie Murphy, he's kind of there a little bit for Eddie Murphy, and probably his more memorable bits are him with Eddie, right, doing impersonations. And he does that movie, The Dead Heat. Is it Dead Heat, where he's a zombie cop?
I don't know that one.
With Treat Williams, I think it's him and Treat Williams, called Dead Heat. He got really buff for that comedy special. Remember that? Steroids were hot.
Yes, he did.
And you know, to your point about this dude kind of does all the little schlocky shit. Like, look, he made it, quote unquote, to a certain point in Hollywood, but I don't know what made Joe Piscopo interesting other than his last name.
I think that he's good for that era of entertainer. He's great. It's just, it doesn't age well. Most of the superstars that we look at from the 60s and 70s, if we watch an episode of Ed Sullivan's show, okay, so what else do they do?
Yeah,
I get it. He can spin plates. That's cool. Mm-hmm. What else? Does he speak Portuguese or something? Well, anyway, I was trying to figure out, because on that 86 special, I believe, mm-hmm. Piscopo, 86, 87, he does a David Lee Roth parody in the middle of it. It's a song that's kind and a look that's kind of making fun of Yankee Rose. So I was going, okay, I can't get Piscopo. I'll get his co-writer. So I looked up this guy, Sam Ingrafia. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, he's got some credits. And I reached out and I sent the email, and then I realized, oh, he did the special after. He didn't work on this one. He did the one. But you know what? I'll still interview him. And then he's like, oh, I met Roth. I was possibly going to have a role in Crazy from the Heat. So going back to before I sidebarred, we know from my Billy Sheehan interview that he was costumed. We know that there was crew, there was locations, Dave had a residence on the lot there, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But what Dave Jellison told me was the Eat 'Em and Smile album was supposed to be the soundtrack to the movie. Mm-hmm. In other words, Dave was going to be a movie star like Madonna, Cher, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. He was going on to greener pastures. Movie falls apart, and it's like, oh, I guess it's an album. I guess I'm a touring solo artist.
And you know, it's funny because I think Desperately Seeking Susan comes out around 84 too, right? 84, 85.
Yeah. And supposedly they rushed that one out because they didn't think that Madonna was going to be more than a one or two hit wonder. Ever heard that?
Look, let's be honest. Let's be honest here for a second. Who would have thunk that Madonna would have 50 million records and Cyndi Lauper would be the one that we look at as a one hit, maybe two hit wonder?
No. I'm taking you to the mat on that one. Cyndi Lauper has Broadway money. Kinky Boots is her.
Look, I'm not saying the woman isn't talented. That's my point. I think Cyndi Lauper isn't just a crazy haired woman that is a part of pro wrestling.
Yes. Without her, there's no rock and wrestling connection. Yeah. Fact.
But if you ask the average person about Madonna, you can ask the average person about Madonna that's our age. Mm-hmm. That's my daughter's age. My daughter's 25. And they know who Madonna is. she's a bit of a meme now at this point of her life.
Yes.
But Madonna, I mean, even the millennial generation knows Madonna. I mean, you don't have Lady Gaga is just, you know, Truth or Dare era Madonna over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, well, it's all because Cyndi Lauper had to put the Iron Sheik in her music videos.
Captain Lou ruined everything. Wendy Richter and Captain Lou ruined everything. Or the Fabulous Moolah, I guess.
Ruined Volkoff and,
oh, man. I had to do some research for this thing that I'm doing. It's less about – wrestling is a major part of it, but it's more about the way we dissect media. And I think we're currently in a state of political kayfabe.
Political kayfabe. Oh, man. Yeah. I can't wait to read it or see what this is.
I will shoot you the trailer. So I juxtapose the rise of Vince McMahon and WWE against the rise of cable news television. They happen around the same time.
Well, very interesting point there. And with Ted Turner being a focal point of both of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think you'll dig it.
Absolutely.
And the culmination. So we were changing it from a movie. We were all set to get it done a couple weeks ago. We're finishing up. And the director came down here to Mexico. I won't bore you with that story. It is kind of funny. And we decided it's got to be episodic.
Yes.
Because there's too much.
Yeah.
And it was too dense in certain parts. And we're like, let's just draw it out. And I think we got maybe 5 to 6 episodes. And
yeah.
So, you know, when we're off air, I'll tell you more about it.
So when in the storyline does Dave TV, the rise of Dave TV, intersect with the two? And then LTV? Because those are all along the lines of the
I don't rise. Have any Dave TV in it. It's definitely.
And no LTV?
No.
Oh.
No, I do not.
I think you're serious plot point missing, Jason.
I think you would be very shocked at some of the wrestling stuff that we were able to get. We have the John Stossel slap.
Oh, Dr. D.
Oh yeah. I'll try to send you as much as I have on it. I think you'll dig what we put together so far.
The slap heard around the world.
Well, John Stossel ended up suing. I believe he lost hearing in an ear.
And the Richard Belzer thing was around the same time too, right?
Yeah. Oh, we got Andy Kaufman's in it.
Nice.
Oh yeah, trust me.
Every person that Vince McMahon wants to pretend like never existed.
There's a lot of we have a whole chapter on the Montreal Screwjob.
Oh.
And how that relates to like talk show television, daytime talk show television of the 90s.
Do you ever see the really weird clip of the imposter Sammy Hagar showing up at a WWF show on TV?
There's an imposter Sammy Hagar.
It's like 86.
Isn't that just every old white guy? Isn't it every old white guy at like the county fair?
It's at Madison Square Garden. I think Howard Finkel or whoever's announcing for WWF is like, ladies and gentlemen, the new lead singer Van Halen, Sammy Hagar. Mm-hmm. And a guy that looks like Eddie Money in a blazer slides into the ring, you know, does a wave and people cheer. And I don't think they ever corrected anything. They go, that was not Sammy.
Fake Sammy. I don't know. I want to meet fake Sammy Hagar and be like, you know, you look like every white guy that just didn't make it.
Well, he wears sunglasses indoors. It's a very short list of people who do the sunglasses indoors. It's like him, Corey Feldman, Howard Stern. I don't know who else does the sunglasses indoors thing.
Unless you're blind. Like, the lights aren't that bright, brother.
Roth actually does the sunglasses indoors thing, too. Diddy. And we know how well things are going for Diddy.
Well, right? Again, yeah, well. We're coming for you. Well, you know.
I heard that Booker T drop. Yeah. He doesn't wear sunglasses indoors. I was on a cruise that Booker T was on. Big dude. Do not. Yes. That's a Booker T.
Yes. So when my ex and I weren't touring, we would do like stupid jobs. That's why people always make fun. You'll see people in the chat making fun of me about all the jobs I've had. It's because you get done doing a run like 6 weeks. You can't just go back to a regular job. So we would do these ridiculous jobs. So we were in between runs. I think we were in between international runs. And we got jobs working for WWE Access when it was in San Jose. So this is like 2014, I think, 2014, 2015.
At Levi's Stadium?
Mm-hmm. So Access is when they have all the fans come and they get to meet the wrestlers, right? So that was like the 2 or 3 days later. So literally every wrestler is there, right? And who was alive right just before Piper passed? And Booker T walked by, and my ex, bless her heart, I will preface this by saying that she's Canadian, doesn't know anything about wrestling culture, and not that much about hip hop.
Sure.
But Booker T walked by, and she goes, "Man, everybody's here. Busta Rhymes is here." I grabbed her. I was like, "Don't go up to him and say he's Busta Rhymes. That is not Busta Rhymes. Just go back to helping Goldust. Just go help Goldust. Goldust needs an assistant. Just
wow, and live to tell about it."
Yeah,
yeah. I nothing but respect for King Booker. Nothing but respect, but the people on that cruise who were trying to bug him while he's eating breakfast or lunch with his wife, God help him.
Oof.
He could snap into heel mode in a second.
That was an interesting job to work, because there was a debriefing we had about like, hey, these fans are a different kind of, they're a different breed. Blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to get into all of it. I want to shit on.
No, they're like David Lee Roth fans. Oh. I think Van Halen David Lee Roth fans are other people who like six Van Halen hits, mm-hmm. or the people who know the exact pickup setup that yeah. Eddie had and his pedal board and deep tracks on David Lee Roth's 1994 album, and they're scary. It is a scary fan base, like wrestling fans. People don't realize that Van Halen, it's informal or obsessive. It's one or the other.
And yeah, because like Bret Hart was the last day, and Bret Hart is there. And he got all these gifts from people.
Sure.
And he took them, thank you, blah, blah, blah. And then he left. He left all the gifts. And I went to go try to give him the gifts, and they grabbed me. They're like, "Throw all that shit away." I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Man, you would be surprised at what people send these guys. Stuff with shit cooked into it. They poison, like, just throw it away. Don't open it. You don't want to know what's in it. If it's $1 million, oh well, throw it away."
One of my mysteries, I'm putting this out into the world, one of the few interviews I have not been able to get over the years is Bret Hart. The reason I want to speak with him is because everyone thinks of the Hart family as these Canadian icons. Mm-hmm. Yet the reality is Bret Hart's mom and dad met in my town, Long Beach, Long Island, New York.
Okay.
The dad, Stu Hart, was a lifeguard. I think the mom was from here. And again, like, they're from here. And this town also gave the world Rick Rubin. For better and for worse, it gave the world Rick Rubin. And so therefore, Def Jam and MF Doom and Lil Peep. Billy Crystal, lots of random people came from here, and I just have not been able to get Bret or anyone.
A friend of mine that had a mildly successful music career is from your hood. If you know the hardcore band Glassjaw.
Oh yeah, I went to high school with somebody related to them.
I recorded with Todd Weinstock.
Oh yeah.
I recorded with Todd with LaFenn. We have a song that we did with him and. Good dude.
Yeah, they are more famous outside of Long Island than on Long Island. The emo scene and all the metal bands that came from around here, like Orange and 9mm and Taking Back Sunday and Brand New, Last Draw from Autumn to Ashes, all that came from here. And the smallest gig they do on the tour is usually here.
I want to ask you about that real quick. And I know it's a bit of a departure. And look, if we're boring you guys watching the show, let me know, because I can talk to Darren.
Likewise, if we got to do a part two, or we got to get you on the DLR cast, we'll have you.
Oh, soon. please. I would love to come on and talk shit with you.
Sure.
I watched a really great documentary about Twisted Sister.
Okay.
And it was very eye opening for me, because I didn't know Twisted Sister, A, was that much older than their contemporaries of the early 80s, and B, had such a successful career in the upstate New York kind of, because I don't know if they're from Long Island, but you know,
they're from, some of them are from Long Island. They cut their teeth on Long Island and New York City, but mostly Long Island. Yes.
And upstate, and kind of playing that whole area up there. Mm-hmm. I have played up there, definitely not to, you know, Twisted Sister numbers that they were doing back in the day, but had a ball playing up there. It's kind of a different world when you think of New York. It was interesting to hear Dee Snider say why they never played New York City. Mm-hmm. And he was like, how many can CBGBs hold? 200? We're playing at 3,000 to 5,000 a night. I was like,
CBGB, I'm going to assume most people who will hear this or see this never got to go to CBGB. There are a few things that are more overrated in life that suck more, that everyone talks about so highly, than CBGB. It was filthy. The sound was terrible. The beer was overpriced and garbage. It smelled bad. The worst bathrooms of any venue. Under 200 people held comfortably. But they could go, yeah, well, the Ramones played here, and Weezer, and Blondie, and Talking Heads. It sucked. It was the worst. It was next to a homeless outreach place, so you did not feel safe there. It was in the middle of this like Chinatown part that sold restaurant supplies. So everything sucked about it, except the cover charges were cheap. Other than that, it was probably a band was playing at 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, and they were trying to get you out of there as quick as possible. It sucked.
Jesus.
The shirt looks cool. The venue sucked.
There's a movie about it that's whatever. There's a documentary about it that's mildly interesting. But, you know, look, you've been in enough little crappy rooms that have horrible bathrooms that you just like, I'm just going to hold it. I'm just going to hold it until we leave.
Yeah, it was the worst. And also there was like three shows going on at the same time, because there was the regular stage, there was the downstairs, and then I think it was called the 313 Gallery. Mm-hmm. And what did they do when they tore it up? They turned it into a John Varvatos store.
You know why? Because Varvatos didn't want to turn into a Starbucks. Did you know that?
I didn't know that part. I knew that Guns N' Roses played at that store. I went to a Tommy Ramone book signing event. It did some cool stuff. And I respect that Varvatos has put out albums by John 5 and all that. But New York City is just... It's no Oakland.
Oakland is it? Oakland.
Somebody in the chat comment said the whiskey. The whiskey is 85 times cooler than CBGB ever. It's
bigger. Whiskey's got to be like 600 people. No, it's 300 people, 400 people in whiskey. It's
probably 300 or so, but whiskey is so much cooler.
There's so much stuff to do. Dude, if you go to the whiskey, and then you go to like the Roxy, or you just go to the Rainbow after you see a show at the Whiskey. Look, I'm from the Bay, but I grew up in this hair metal era, and I'm not the biggest hair metal fan, but I'm big enough. And there's nothing I love more than if we're playing LA to go to the Rainbow afterwards and just freaking hang out at the Rainbow.
Pizza's great there.
Food is good. Yep. Vibe is chill. Love that. Actually, me and Ben Burgess, this past Valentine's Day, we're both divorcees and single. We did a Who Wants to Hang Out with a Bunch of Single Communists at the Rainbow, and we just last minute told people that we're gonna be hanging out there, and then a small handful of people showed up, and we had a great time at the Rainbow, and we'll probably do the same thing again. I love that place. I love that spot. And since you talked to Rat,
Yeah.
Can
yeah.
you hook up? I don't care if you want to co-host it with me. Can we do an episode with anybody from Rat? Percy looks like he's got stories galore. And I got questions galore.
When you say any member of Rat, now you better be careful about that one, because there's dozens of former members. A former member of Rat could be, you know, the bartender at this place or whatever.
I know what you're talking about, because again, playing LA, you know, you're like, hey, you look familiar. Yeah, I'm the guitar player from Goldfinger. What?
Like, don't you? There's a lot of former members of Goldfinger. Yeah, right?
It's like, God damn, like, what are you doing here?
There's Guns yeah. members everywhere. There's Rat members everywhere. Yeah, I'll I interviewed Piercy for my book, and I'll reach out to his lady slash manager, because I have to send her a copy of that. I'll see if he's doing press, and if not, then give me your 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th picks for Rat. I don't think I can get Bobby Blotzer. I think Blotz has to trust you.
I don't Blotz think just D-Martin. Yells, man. I'm not ready to get yelled at, and I'm not ready to get all the rope. I don't know if I can handle Blotzer. I'm not ready for it.
I think you could charm Blotzer easily. You give him a lot of bros and dudes,
mm-hmm.
and he feels you. Now, Warren, I want to know everything about Warren DeMartini, because most talented guy from that scene, arguably.
Yeah.
Still married to the same person.
Yeah.
Kept his money and vanished. And just doesn't.
He doesn't fuck with none of y'all.
Yeah. He avoids all the drama. He married a model, had a kid.
I'm not mad at him. I mean, I remember we played this when I was tour managing a band.
Yeah.
We were in Cleveland at this spot, and I can't remember the name of the spot, and the dude that owned it was one of the guys in Warrant after the 90s.
Oh, okay. So this was Billy Morris's club.
Dude was hella cool. I'm not going to say what happened, but yeah, he was hella cool.
Oh, side story. And then you could kick me off after this.
No.
When one of my first jobs out of college, or maybe my first job out of college, was for Twisted Sister's manager in the heyday, who mm-hmm. still worked with D in the year since then. And at that time, he was managing this hair metal band that's always done better in Europe and Japan than here, called TNT.
Yeah. You ever? Yes. Okay.
So it was really hard to manage them from the U.S. because 4/5 of the band was in Norway. The singer was in the U.S. So it's expensive to get them to do anything. There's so many logistics and visas and all that. And most publicists, you'd be like, do you want to represent TNT? And they'd be like, I can't. There's not a tour. There's not a label thing. What are we going to do? So I called this one woman who's like, I'd love to. Let's talk. And she goes, hey, Janie Lane is here. Whoa. Can I put him on the phone? And I'm like, yeah.
Sure.
To Janie Lane. This is like probably 05.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically, just as a way to keep him on the line, I go, oh, I can help you with some digital distribution if you want to get one of your solo albums out. He's like, what's your email address? And I gave him my email address. And then I started getting chain letters and email forwards from Janie Lane. And he didn't know how to BCC. So you'd look at all the recipients of the emails and be like, oh, that's the guy from Dokken. Oh, that's
the guy from Damn.
I loved it so much. And I always thought he was one of the greatest songwriters that got pigeonholed as being a hair metal guy. I loved Janie Lane's music.
That man broke my heart when when I saw his interview.
Yeah.
Before he passes away. If that doesn't break your heart. First of all, I didn't know Janie Lane was the dude behind Warren
yep.
playing, writing all the songs. And I don't think he recorded the guitar parts.
He was capable, but he was a drummer first, but he could play everything. He could do everything. And there's a good amount of Warrant in the DLR book, because they opened up the Little Ain't Enough tour. Joey Allen was around stuff, so he knew some stuff that other people didn't know. But people are like, yeah, the Cherry Pie Band. You're like, there's so much more to Warrant.
You know what else? Okay, a super sidebar.
So yeah.
Now it's getting into like nerd hair metal territory. Exactly. Stuff. Yeah. I'm warning you guys now. So there's a bar here in Tijuana that is the coolest bar ever. They have these TVs that they pump through the sound system in the joint, and you can request songs, 10 pesos a song. And if it's on YouTube, they'll play it. And I, we go there with the director kid, and we're hanging out at this bar. And it's, you know, it's Mexico, so you ask for a beer and they give you a 40 ounce. Right? For like $3. It's a big ass 40.
Yeah.
And so, and everybody's always in a good mood, and depending on the song, the whole bar will sing along. So much fun in this spot, right? They start playing Firehouse songs. Firehouse deep cuts. And we're sitting there, and I'm like, I think that's Firehouse. Because you don't always see the name of the group when it comes up on the screen.
Yeah.
And all I know from Firehouse is Love of a Lifetime. Right?
They rock. Everybody knows. Hold Your Fire.
They were heavy. Somebody requested all the heavy Firehouse songs. And I was like, dude. Maybe Firehouse hit in Mexico way harder than they hit in the States, because I didn't know any of these songs existed.
Yeah, Asia too. When I say Asia, most people, you say Asia and they think Japan. Firehouse was doing Vietnam and the rare countries. So Firehouse was killing it in the 90s. A lot of the hair bands, I keep having to do air quotes, but like... Mm. Scorpions were hitting up every third world country and ruling the arenas there when grunge hit, and that's Firehouse did pretty well.
That's interesting, because I think it was, they were somewhere in Asia, because it was like, this is like Firehouse of Japan or something. It definitely wasn't Budokan, but it was a decent sized room, and they were just killing it. Heavy. Yeah. The sound was great. It was like a professionally shot thing. Again, I grew up with that music. It's, you know, I am wearing a, you know, Megadeth original album cover shirt, because I don't care what Dave says. This album cover scared the hell out of me. It looked like a madman's basement. I'm terrified. This is the scariest record I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I also loved the, I'm a huge Motley Crue fan. I'm a huge Rat fan. I actually like White Lion, and not ironically. There's no irony in me.
No, White Lion's super underrated. Vito Bratta, one of the greatest guitar players, and no one talks about as a guitar hero.
Yeah. An amazing guitar. Oh, that's the solo on Wait is so tasteful.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. Oh.
I'm with you there. We're
look, you want to talk about like hair metal?
We'll talk about 80s jobbers in WWF. Coco Beware and Prince's possible friendship. And
all that. Look, if you want to talk about all that stuff, Pop Life, every Wednesday we could do it. And I'm sure no one will object. I do want to kind of get back to the David Lee Roth thing before I get yelled at by people like, oh, the comments. You didn't even talk about David Lee Roth enough.
We'll just show the book, so that way, there you go.
can you talk a little bit about, because now I want to go off on so many hair metal tangents with you. Like, we've opened up a frightening door here. You said something in the book that effed my head up.
Oh, boy. Okay, what was that?
There's a few things in the book that effed my head up. The movie thing, you just said, after my head up, the whole Prince and David Lee Roth. But Ozzy Osbourne, right? Again, Ben Burgess, good friend of mine, used to live two doors down. He loves an era of Ozzy that I am not the biggest fan of. And some people call it the hair metal era of Ozzy. I call it that. Some people yell at me for calling it that. I love Jakey Lee. I used to own Jakey Lee guitars. Not his model, like literal stuff that Bernie Rico had made for him. I got in a trade with one of your, I think, Long Island people or Jersey people. This guy's name was, his real name's Jack Frost, and he played in Sabotage.
We traded.
I had a Dave Mustaine King V with EMG pickups, and he sent me these two Bernie Rico guitars that were made for Jakey Lee that Jakey Lee just never got because he was just, you know, snowed, allegedly.
Yeah.
He's doing great now. Bark at the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
And I always want to say Shout at the Devil. It's the ultimate sin.
The one with Shot in the Dark.
Shot in the Dark. But yeah, that's the ultimate sin, right? That's the name of the record?
I believe so, yeah.
When you said that Ozzy was so inspired by David Lee Roth, he dyed his hair and Van Halen and tried to get the kind of Van Halen-esque shredder, because I was reading something else that had nothing to do with you about what is his name? Randy Rhoads not liking Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
So yeah, when he went to audition for Ozzy, I think Ozzy says something along the lines of, like, you know, he blew his mind. He goes, I'm kind of out of it, but just show up tomorrow because I think you're amazing. And he gets his Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
And if you listen to, and this is my opinion, I mean, people may disagree, but listen to those Ozzy records and then listen to Black Sabbath stuff. It sounds nothing alike.
Nothing alike. And Randy and Eddie were kind of LA guitar rivals. The yes. documentary that came out, that was long in the making, that yeah. came out like a year and a half ago on Randy mm-hmm. Rhoads, talked about the Eddie-Randy rivalry. It might have been sensationalized a little bit, but that was Ozzy among one example of many of him just copying other people. Ozzy's not the first to do anything that I can think of. It's usually one or two people did it first. He goes, oh, that works. Or at least Sharon says, that works. We'll do that.
At least Sharon says. I mean, I didn't put those two things together like that, because I think just Ozzy's, by his very nature of the Black Sabbath association, even though that music was so mid-range driven and so over the top mm-hmm. and hooky, I still didn't make the Van Halen connection.
Yeah, true. And they did tour together in the late 70s. That was Van Halen's first big arena tour, opening for Black Sabbath.
Yeah. And that's when it was over for Ozzy. And you talk
about supposedly, that. Yeah. And Black Sabbath, another Warner Brothers band. So the reason I keep calling out Warner Brothers is that, you know, your label is usually telling you, hey, be more like our top seller, that kind of a thing. So, and they look at what trends are working for them. And they go, be a little more like your brother right there. And of course, Black Sabbath had success 7 years or so before Van Halen did.
Mm-hmm.
They'd done multiple world tours before Van Halen really took off. And Van Halen was not an overnight success. Like that first US tour of Van Halen was opening first of three for mm-hmm. Journey, who was still not like the mega huge band.
And they weren't even Steve Perry Journey yet, right? They were still.
It was Steve Perry, but it was still when Greg Raleigh was in the band, when they were still a little prog. Like this is probably 5 years before Don't Stop Believing. And it was first of three, and these were not massive arenas. These were huge clubs, small theaters.
Mm-hmm. So, it's a different, yeah. Again, Van Halen, man. Imagine seeing that. I wish I could have seen Van Halen open up for Black Sabbath. Was that Van Halen 2?
I used to think that. And did you watch the 84 Van Halen Donington thing that got leaked like 3-4 months ago?
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. Long story short, I think Van Halen live from that era is better in our heads, us visualizing what happened, than what actually happened. Because Van Halen live in that era was a lot of solos, and it was a lot of DLR banter. A lot. It had a Michael Anthony bass solo. That's a lot.
Interesting.
Unless you like bass solos.
I don't know. It depends. You know, is it Bootsy? Is it Larry Graham? Is it...
Michael Anthony, there is no slap bass happening.
Nope. I think he plays with a pick, doesn't he?
He plays with a pick. There's no slap. And it's not virtuoso-esque. And it's just like, oh, that base is weirdly shaped. It's the least impressive base. The only person who could do a less impressive base solo would be Bobby Dahl from Poison.
So we had Tom Worman on the show.
Oh, nice.
And I asked him a little bit about Poison, but he did the second record and not the first record.
Yeah.
So he had nothing bad to say about Poison, and he knew how to play and blah, 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 blah. But there's this great interview. There's a show called Full in Bloom. Listen to it.
I love that.
This guy does great in-depth interviews. He's some sort of music insider, and I wouldn't be surprised if he's from it. I don't think he's from LA, but he's somehow really in with the LA scene.
He has a Southern accent.
He has a Southern accent, but I wouldn't be surprised if he made the move. I mean, come on, it's LA. You know how many people I know with a Southern accent in LA? And he has on the guy that produced that first Poison record, and this dude is just ripping them apart.
Was that Rick Broud or is that
Browdy? Is that his name?
Yeah. That's the ripping guy who Poison found his address from a Rat record or something like that.
Is that how it, dude? He tells the story about like this is and Michael Wagner is supposed to mix it, and he's asking like, should I take points? He's like, man, don't take the points. Ain't nobody gonna buy this crap. This is bad trash. And you know, the rest is history. But watch or listen to that interview, because it's, you can quote unquote watch it. It's on YouTube, but it's all audio.
Yeah.
And if you're into music, he definitely gets into the what boards were you using, how'd you mic this stuff. If you're not into that kind of stuff, I can see how those interviews do get a little boring, but he does cut clips of the juicy parts. And he has this dude just ripping everyone except for CC apart, saying that they didn't know how to play. Bret Michaels had to record each line individually because he was so bad. He had no rhythm.
Yeah.
Oof. But no, Worman didn't say anything bad about Poison.
I also had the pleasure of interviewing Tom. Like and respect the hell out of Tom. Mm-hmm. Poison, the word always was, no one will work harder than them. They are always working hard. They'll do it as many times as it takes to get it right. But at the same time, I feel bad ripping on Poison, but they do the thing where to everyone's face, they're the nicest people on earth.
Mm-hmm.
They dude bro you to death. Mm-hmm. They'll go, oh, dude, you totally should come to our show tonight. Mm-hmm. And then you reach out to management or their publisher or their publicist, and you go, hey, Brett said I should get tickets. And they're like, sold out.
And you go,
they do that. I don't know if do you have a term for that?
Douche?
It's
like, no, we say you're a fucking douche.
Anytime.
Well, That's LA shit. This is a true story. I'm going to David Lee Roth the fuck out of this show. This is a true story. And Darren, thank you for talking to me, and apologize to Mrs. Paltrowitz for keeping your ass so long. I'm sorry. True story. Tour managing this band. They have a new single out, by the way. These are great friends of mine. They're called The Last Nova. They're like a hard rock band, a contemporary hard rock band. And we were in El Paso. We were in El Paso. And they were supposed to do a radio thing, and something got messed up with the radio thing. They moved venues last minute. It was supposed to be like a radio thing for like an AC/DC show, blah, 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 blah. Whatever. The radio guy actually went to the wrong venue, which was the right venue. That makes any sense. So he saw the band play, and the band made like really good, or makes, I guess they're still around, really good radio friendly, heavy rock music in the vein of like Breaking Benjamin, that kind of stuff. If you're a fan of Seven Dust, just band stuff.
Sure.
And the radio guy goes, hey, tomorrow this tour is coming to town. It's the Metalocalypse band. I can't think of
the name. The Adult Swim band.
Yeah, the Adult Swim band.
Billy Broche. Yeah.
Converge and Mastodon. And they're gonna be in Las Cruces, which is 45 minutes away It's in New Mexico. It was like 45 minutes away. He's like, mm-hmm. come with me to this meet and greet. And we go with him to the meet and greet. We meet the guys, and Troy from Mastodon is there, and Bill, and they're shaking everybody's hands. And the radio guy introduces me. He goes, oh, this is the band's tour manager. This is Nova. They're from California, and they're on tour, and we have a day off, and blah, 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 blah. And so Troy goes, do you guys have tickets? We're like, nah, we just, you know, homie just hooked us up. He goes, oh, word? Fuck that. How many of y'all is there? Da-da-da-da-da. Okay. And then after the show, come find me, and then we finna hang. And I was like, all right. We see the show. We have a ball. We go try to find the guys after the show, right? Which is, we don't have the things. We don't have the badges or anything.
Yeah.
So we ask Scary, like, we beg Scary, like, hey, can you please go get Troy and tell Troy Jason and the band is waiting? And Security goes, man, if I get, and then finally Security goes, and Troy comes back. Jay gives us hugs. We go backstage. They have a full spread, and they're like, we know you guys. We know what it's like on the road when you know, ain't nobody paying you. Whatever you need, take it. Y'all need showers? Whatever y'all need. Da-da-da-da-da. There's still real dudes out there.
That's great.
That know what it's like. And they respect you if it's a real connection. And if you do that come to the show shit, that's some LA bullshit. And then you're like, ah, I'm not fucking with you anymore. That's that shit that makes me, I'm not fucking with you anymore. You know what I mean?
Brett told me that I should come to the show early and he'll play guitar with me backstage. hey, look, when you meet the people that are worthwhile, then it's all worth it. I think that's the great takeaway from it all. But Jason, you're one of those people, and I can't thank you enough for having me.
Darren, last question.
Bring it.
What would you say most people don't know about David Lee Roth that you want really to get across in your book?
That he never stopped creating. There's just because he didn't have a solo album out or a world tour that year, doesn't mean that he wasn't writing music, he wasn't coming up with ideas, wasn't trademarking things, not painting, not learning a language, not filming stuff. There's all this stuff. And this book, as comprehensive as it is, I think that there's still so many mysteries that are needing to be found out. So don't be surprised if there's a part two, if, you know, eventually people tip me off to more recording sessions and more paintings and more pieces of art. I think that is a possibility.
His name is Darren Paltrowitz. He has the Paltrowcast, but the book link is in the description. Darren, thank you so much for hanging out. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for hanging out with me. Darren, this was way too much fun. And I want to add a caveat on that Mastodon story. We kept hanging out, and we ended up going to some club. And then a bunch of models came. It was crazy. It was a lot of fun. We had a good time. Good dudes. There really is good dudes out there that'll be men of their word. So thank you guys. Darren, if you're still there in the green room, let's chat. And the show will be back tomorrow night with some familiar faces that you guys haven't seen in a while. I'm not going to say who. Just be surprised. Peace.